Oye, qué bueno está. Ay, Maricela. Ay, la tan buena. Oye, qué bueno está.
The song.
Dick, give me the signal.
He's going to play the music first.
Okay.
Let's get going. Good evening. This is the WILP radio show, our wake-up call, where we connect the dots between a lot of the issues of the day, the issues in our community, in our state, and in our nation. And we have a guest today that we're very delighted to have, somebody I'm just meeting for the first time, except on the phone, Daryl Walker. And she's here to talk about Bill Dow, who is pretty well known, especially around sustainable agriculture circles in Chapel Hill and Carrboro. He was the founder of the Carrboro's Farmers Market.
One of them, right.
One of the founders of the Carrboro Farmers Market, one of the early organic farmers in this area. And I'm not going to say any more, Daryl. You want to say how you got to know Bill?
Well, sure. how did I get to know Bill?
Hello and welcome to the show, by the way.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me. I guess I first knew who he was at the market, but I didn't really get to know him there. He and I went to the same church for several years.
Oh.
And I was living in Chapel Hill at the time and was interested that there was a doctor who had turned into an organic farmer. I thought that was a really strange kind of switch. I'd never heard of that before. So I knew him a little bit at uh-huh. church. We'd sort of chat in the parking lot once in a while, but I didn't know him well. And then I saw him occasionally at the farmer's market more intentionally. I'd say, oh, well, you know, I need to buy something from this person and this church I'm going to. He's trying to make a living farming. And I didn't really know that much about him. But then many years later, I moved to Chatham County when I divorced. And I started going to the church in a regular way. And also, because I was still teaching at that time and traveling around the state.
Well, what kind of teaching were you doing?
I was doing drama teaching.
Wow.
With children in the classroom. It wasn't big performance uh-huh. kind of drama. It was, well, it was a kind of improv, uh-huh. really, where we did role plays and the children had to make up their own dialogue.
And what age children were you working
well,
with?
Well, my particular age group was anywhere from about third grade through eighth grade.
Because Emily's a retired teacher. Emily O'Hare is our videographer. And Dick Paddock is our co-host.
Good evening.
And engineer. Thank you, Dick. Yeah. So we're here and with Daryl Walker, and we're talking about Bill Dow and how she met him. And I didn't know that you had been a drama teacher with kids. That's so wonderful.
Well, it was a lot of fun, and I still do a little bit of it once in a while. I've actually worked with adults as well,
uh-huh.
so it's kind of covered the gamut because I worked with a school system called the North Carolina A-plus Schools, which was and still is a designated group of low-performing schools that use art, drama, music, and movement to teach the core curriculum.
Oh, my God, which, that is...
Yeah, it's really amazing.
In North Carolina?
Yes.
They have
yes.
such an innovative program?
That's right.
Well, that's very exciting.
We do. In fact, we're now part of the North Carolina Arts Council.
Uh-huh.
We started back in, I think, 95 with one test school in Wilmington
uh-huh.
and then expanded to 12 the next year, which is when I started as one of the drama educators. And I think we have about 35 or 40 schools now, and we're in three different states. And it's a reform program because we go to low-performing schools,
yeah.
But we have to have at least 85% buy-in of the faculty because the teachers have to start using the arts to teach the core curriculum.
Are any of them in Durham?
There were a couple in Durham. I'm not sure if they're still there because I haven't done it for the last 5 years.
Okay.
And it does change because what we try to do is get them up and running so that they can then be self-sustaining because we have limited funding.
Mm-hmm.
And then we want to expand and go to other, you know.
So then you moved to Chatham.
So I moved to Chatham. I got involved with the Arts Council and then started going to this church more.
And which church was that?
This was the Pittsburgh Presbyterian Church in town. And one afternoon, Bill and I were talking, and he was divorced and I was divorced at this point. And we had this long conversation out in the parking lot and talked about sort of getting together and so on and so forth. And he said, well, if you really want to get to know me, you're really going to have to come and work on the farm. And I said, what? Work on the farm? I'm a teacher. I don't want to work on the farm. And besides that, I pulled enough weeds for my dad as a kid in the vegetable garden at home. I don't ever want to pull another weed. And he said, well, then you can come out and pick blueberries. You don't have to pick. You don't. And I said, well, I'm only here about 1 or 2 weeks a month. And he said, well, you just call me. We have picking days and we always need extra people. Well, I thought this man was kind of interesting, so I called him at some point and said, all right, I'll come pick blueberries. And that's how it started. So anyway, but Bill, this book, What I Stand On, that's just come
out.
We'll
hold that up for the camera.
Yeah, What I Stand On.
And that's just come out about a month ago?
Just came out about a month ago.
And you got this book together?
Well, yes and no. Actually, Fred Broadwell is really the one to
give credit.
He called it Practical Advice and Cantankerous Musings from a Pioneering Organic Farmer.
And it's called What I Stand On.
What I Stand On, which is a quote from Wendell Berry, who Bill loved. That was his favorite writer and hero.
So yeah. this is words and writings from Bill Dow.
Well, it's words. And what happened was Fred decided.
And Fred is an organic farmer?
No, Fred is more of a sustainable ag consultant now.
Okay.
He worked with Carolina Farm Stewardship for quite a few years.
We had talked to. Is that something that Bill helped start?
Yes, he helped start that as well.
And I think I told you my grandson, a shout out to Jared Cates.
Yeah, Jared, right.
My grandson works there for the last 3 or 4 years. Yeah, yes.
Yeah. And he helped start the farm tour and the sustainable ag program at the college.
At the college.
In Pittsburgh, which is now just a wonderful program.
Which is, we haven't even gotten into his innovative programs as a physician. We're just here in North Carolina The innovative programs that he started here as an organic farmer, one of the early organic farmers.
Well, what happened, you asked how he came to North Carolina. He actually came to North Carolina as a physician to take part at the hospital in, I think it was called the Johnson Fellows Program, and there was sort of a hand-picked group of physicians from all over the country that were invited to come and take these various seminars and study and what have you for a year. And he had been at Vanderbilt and done his residency and intern residency and then had gone on to work in Appalachia.
And was he invited for that special program because of his great working or innovative programs in Tennessee?
Right, because
in Appalachia.
He had organized something called the Student Health Coalition from Vanderbilt and kind of had, with some others, had handpicked a group of folks to go up and work into East Tennessee where there were no medicine, no doctors. And they basically did community organizing.
Yeah.
And they went in, got to know the community by starting with a health fair and then invited folks to get to know them. And then they ended up staying in their homes over a period of time. And then it just expanded, and they found out what the folks in these communities wanted, and then they helped go out and get money from Ford Foundation and all these different funding groups. Mm-hmm. So that they ended up, you know, building clinics, mm-hmm. and they would staff them on weekends with mm-hmm. the Vanderbilt physicians, and they were big promoters of nurse practitioners, which were very, very new at that time.
Yes.
And
because we're talking probably 30 years ago.
That's right. It was the end of the 70s, early 80s.
Yeah. 40 years ago.
Yeah. And I knew very little about this when I knew Bill, because he was a very modest man. And I kept saying, Bill, what is the Student Health Coalition?
Yeah.
Well, we just got a bunch of folks together and went up to find out what people wanted and tried to help them make it. That was it.
Yeah.
That's all I was like. And it wasn't until he died that when I started going through all these papers and records and people were calling me and talking to me, that I learned about what an extensive project this was.
Yeah.
And in one of the publications that I read, that I found in his old study, it said that this Student Health Coalition project in Appalachia had been the most innovative project of the 70s and 80s in terms of actually delivering health care to rural communities.
Oh, my gosh.
It was, and I read that and I went, oh, my word. You know, this is amazing.
So because of that, he got invited to the
He had come, right, and he came back for this year, and he said, you know, I've been out community organizing and dealing with all these people, and we've started farmers markets, and we've started solar greenhouses, and we've done all these adjunct things off of the health to try to bring health to people who didn't have a lot of money, but they could grow their own vegetables,
yes.
or they could build their own little houses if they knew how to build a solar greenhouse and have vegetables in the winter. And so he'd gotten all this interest going, and he'd grown up on a farm.
Oh,
and
he had.
Yeah, and very different. I mean, it was a hay horse farm. It wasn't anything organic. And in fact, there's a wonderful chapter in here where he confronts his family, and you know they want to put spray on something, and he doesn't want to put spray on something, and you know it was just a big
generational
rift in the family, big time. But anyway, when he was that year, he thought, I don't think I want to stay in this physician suit. I want to get out. Get my hands dirty and really farm and farm organically. Well, nobody was farming organically in 1981 in North Carolina. And he invited, there's a story in here that I love. He invited the Ag Extension agent to come and give him advice on how to do organic. What should I do with this farm? I'm going to start my own farm.
So he bought a piece of land.
Down in off of, near Pittsburgh, about 6 miles. And I just sold the land in February, so it was like a very sad time. But I'm really happy because there are two wonderful young farmers that are taking it over, named Patricia Parker and Ben Shields, and they've had a really wonderful farm over in Clayton on leased land called In Good Heart Farm. You can go online and see the beautiful vegetables they grow. And they have a CSA, some of whom want to follow them over here. I mean, it's an hour away. You know, it's just, but they've got quite a following. And so they're going to take it over, and I love that.
Oh, that's a good feeling.
I think they'll really honor what Bill started and do it in their own way. But anyhow, I lost my train of thought.
So he called the agricultural extension agent.
Oh, yeah, the agent. So the agent came out. And Bill said, now, you know, I want to try to do this organically. And the guy looked at him like he had three heads. And he said, we don't do organic down here. And Bill said, well, you know, this isn't down here for me. I'm from Mississippi. This is up here.
Up here?
And I'm going to try. And he ended up being the first certified organic farmer in the state of North Carolina.
Oh, my God. He's from Mississippi?
Well, he grew up in Mississippi for part of his life. He was born in Ohio. And then he spent a lot of time there with grandparents in the summer, but then he was in Mississippi for high school, and you know,
wow.
when he went to Vanderbilt, that's where his family was. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So he told the Ag Extension agent he was going to do it. So how did he learn how to do it?
He just trial and error.
Yeah.
Trial and error, and tried this, and then there were a few others that were. you know, more or less trying the same thing. Alex Hitt was one of the early ones.
And wasn't Harvey Harman one of the early?
Harvey Harman. Mm-hmm. I don't know Harvey personally. I know of him.
Uh-huh.
But there were several of them around that were actually beginning to do it.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of them were the ones that really came together to get the carburetor.
And taught each other and helped.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, everything was then pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers and chemicals and all that. So,
so he got his own farm going, learned more and more how to do it, organized with other organic farmers. So what brought on the farmers market? Well, they wanted a place to sell.
Well, they needed a place to sell. And he said that when they first started it, it was down at the Church of Reconciliation parking lot.
Okay.
Because nobody wanted a... You know, they didn't. They tried to do it at Eastgate. He said there was Food Line, or there was none of the pig. I don't know, one of the old grocery stores down there. And he said, "No, you know, we're going to do this." Oh, no, they had a fit. They said, "You're going to steal our business." Well, that was ridiculous because they didn't have that much to begin with.
Yeah.
It was different. You know, that at that time, Piggly Wiggly wasn't growing things like arugula and fennel and things. And they have it now, but they didn't then. And Bill also was one of the first ones to really sell off the back of his truck to restaurants.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that was unheard of back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And, you know, so he pulled up to some of these places, and they went, oh, that's nice. You know, it was just about the time Pie Wacket was starting.
Yes.
If you remember Pie Wacket.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Another a son-in-law worked there.
Is
was
that
the
right?
Kitchen manager.
Yeah.
Muskie Cates, yes.
Oh,
yes.
Muskie. Yes, I know Muskie.
Yes,
sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Small world.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of my family's very interested in sustainable agriculture.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Oh, my.
So, so your Pie Wacket, yes, that was getting started. And there was for a while that little Sunshine Kitchen or something?
Yeah, across the way. I don't know if he sold there. I know he sold to Aurora, which the first
and Aurora,
time, you know, that they were across the street there first, the very
I
first
missed
restaurant.
That. Yes. Yeah. Yes, that's right. So, oh boy, you're bringing back memories.
I say Margaret's. I know Margaret was one of the ones that had them for a long time.
Yeah.
Southern Season, the early Southern Season.
Yes,
you know.
Yes. So they got a good start. And then how did he get doing the Central Carolinas Farm Stewardship?
Well, I think...
Or do you know?
I don't know if he was the very first one or whether he helped develop it. Mm-hmm. I have a feeling you need to talk to Robin Kahanovich, who's really sort of the head of it now.
We'll have to have
and
her here sometime.
She could give
yeah.
you the history better than I could.
Yeah.
But I know he had
one of
input
the early
on
supporters.
Because, and they were looking for advice from a farmer.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them were academics.
And, oh, okay.
So they needed... They needed somebody
because they work on policy. They work
that's
on
right.
agricultural
yeah.
policy,
and theory, and horticulture, and all those different things that farmers need to know.
Mm-hmm. And Alan Spalt, you said he
Alan was key.
Yeah,
he was very key. He still goes to the farmers market faithfully every Saturday. He and Susan, I see it. So funny because I knew Susan way before I ever married when she was a student at UNC, and I was working as a dean there, an assistant dean, and. That was in my early life, way, way back.
all the evolving lives that we have.
And then to have Susan, all of a sudden, you know, 20 years later, I'm looking at her at the farmer's market. I know you.
Oh,
Alan's
gosh.
Wife. Yeah.
So after going and picking the blueberries, evolved from there with you. And
that's right. I just started working out there more and... then,
well, that's one way to the boy. It's a new way to get a girlfriend or to. It doesn't sound very seductive to me. Come work in my farm or come pick my blueberries. That's a new line.
That's right. Well, it was really funny because Bill hardly ever had a date. I mean, it was very difficult to ever make a plan with him because it was like, well. Can we go to so-and-so's for supper next Saturday? I don't know. And I was like, what do you mean you don't know? Well, I don't know if it's going to rain. I might have to plant something.
Well, that's what with
farmers. I don't know if it's, you know.
Yeah.
He said, I can't make any plans until that night. Well, you know, if somebody's invited you to dinner, they need to know if you're coming before that night. So anyway, finally, after many years of getting to know him better, I really did understand. I mean, he was very I mean, that was his number one priority.
Yeah,
I knew I would always be number two, you know, and that was okay.
Well,
but it was.
It's a different kind of mistress, isn't it?
It was, absolutely.
You can't get too jealous.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So did you eventually go live with him? Or?
Well, we traveled together first. Ah. It was interesting because in the winter, he quit farming for 2 months. He just said, I'm not doing it January and February. And in the meantime...
So he could take a break. That's what farmers, it's the slow time, yes?
Well, yeah, although now with, you know, we can do four seasons
with
now.
Climate change, yeah.
I mean, there are all kinds of things you can grow in
but
the winter.
But we used to have a winter.
That's right.
Yes.
We used to have a winter. And way back, I mean, I think all the way back to college, I didn't know this until I had three buildings worth of stuff to go through. The man never threw a thing away. He was an absolute pack rat, but he was also very organized with some things.
Uh-huh.
And he had a passion for family history and genealogy.
Ah.
And he had been collecting with one of his uncles over I don't know how many years, family history and researching and then going off to England and Scotland to research his family. And both sides, of both his mother's and his father's sides, and all the different branches that went off. And he had so much material, I could not believe. And I couldn't believe how much of it he had hand-copied it from documents from the 1800s. And he got one family branch all the way back to about 1784. And, I mean, very thorough research.
Yeah.
In the process of all this, he discovered that, if I hope I have this right, he found his old homestead where his grandfather, great-great-grandfather, for whom he was named, William Watlington Dow, originated. And it was up in the northern part of Scotland, not too far from Perth. Menady, if anybody's out there that knows Scotland, and Dunkeld, that area. And we went up to see this beautiful old farmhouse that's still there. And the farm is still a farm. And you see beautiful mountains off in the distance. It's an absolutely gorgeous spot. But we went over there, and he did more and more and more research. And we traveled together two or three different winters. And I was still teaching. He was farming and so on and so forth. Well, after we did that for, I guess, 3 or 4 years, and we really traveled well together, and we were gone for at least 2 to 3 weeks at a time. And it was funny because the first time we went, I said, well, England and Scotland, I said, you know, I have an old lady friend who is in France, and I promised her if I ever got back to Europe, I'd come see her before she died. I mean, she was like 93 or something.
Yeah.
Bill is going like, I don't speak French. I said, well, I speak enough to get around. I've been there a couple of times, and I have street French, and it'll be fine. And I know the son and the daughter-in-law. I've known them for years, and I've known them since forever, you know, ever since they were married. And we'll get down to Bordeaux. Well, so we went to Bordeaux, and Bill just couldn't believe this woman. I mean, she was just full of energy and joie de vivre, and I mean, you wouldn't have believed she was 93. And we
well,
were
that gives me
sitting
hope.
There.
I want to be like that when I'm 93.
So anyway, every time we went, I said, now, I'd love to go to England, Scotland, but I also want to go to another country. So another year we went to Holland because I had friends in Amsterdam. And then I think...
You got him to expand his...
I got him to expand a little bit. You know, the first one went well, so he was ready to do the second one. And he'd been to Holland once before years ago. So that was a little bit familiar to him. And then the next year, we took part in the Slow Food International Conference, which was in Italy, and he was invited to come to that as a farmer.
Oh, the
with
Slow
the farmers
Food,
and the, you,
yes.
You've heard of Slow
yes.
Food, maybe.
Yes. So that was
that
even
was, and that was
pretty,
in Italy, so
pretty
that was
far
amazing.
Back,
yeah. And, well, they have an international conference every 2 years.
Wow.
And we went, I guess, 2006.
Oh, that must have been wonderful.
It was amazing. There were people from over 100 countries there. And they said, come in your native dress. And we went, what is our native dress? You know, blue jeans. So all the farmers wore their blue jeans. It was a riot. But if we could get there, they gave us complete housing, food, transportation. We stayed at some little wonderful town outside of Torino that took us almost an hour to get there on the bus. But they'd pick us up every morning and take us back at night, and we had three wonderful meals a day. It was amazing.
Oh, wow.
But then I said, okay.
That you ate very slowly.
We ate very slowly. lots. And then I said, okay, but we can't. He said, well, I'm just going to go for the conference. And I said, you mean you're going to fly all the way to Italy just for 5 days? No. No, I said, well, you go home after 5 days. I'm going to stay and go visit a friend of mine in Rome. And if you want to come, I'd love to have you. And he said, well, never been to Rome. Okay, well, so we went to Rome, and then we went to Florence, and we went to Lucca. And you know, he expanded.
He expanded,
he was willing
yeah.
to try something that he didn't speak Italian, but I had learned a little bit, and sort of putting my French and Spanish together, I could manage a little bit. So anyway, that was after we had traveled three or four times together over a period of years and continued, I was working more on the farm at this point and doing less teaching.
What kind of work were you doing on the farm? Picking weeds?
No, I wasn't picking weeds. I was planting sometimes.
Okay.
I was picking produce mainly because his big days, he had three big days. For delivering to restaurants.
Yeah.
And so we needed to prepare and the market. So,
but that's more fun than picking weeds.
And so there was... Is this 2 minutes?
Okay, that means that we're going to have a station break and we can catch our breath. And we do some announcements and say what station we're on. Yeah. So anyhow, so you started picking produce and helping out in the farm more.
Right.
So you two getting closer.
That's right. So that's how we really got to know each other. And we decided that if we could travel so well together, maybe we could live together. So that was what turned out we could.
Yeah.
And we built a house and did. So on the farm. But unfortunately, he died 6 months after we moved into it. So that was really kind of horrendous.
How old was he when he died?
He was very young, 67. And he had bad blood, bad genes with
bad
his heart. He lost his father, his mother, and his brother.
Oh, that's terrible.
Disease. Yeah.
So
yeah.
He was having some bad health problems?
Well, yeah, he was. He was. And
I'm so sorry. Yeah, so that was probably a terrible shock
for
you.
It was. And we had just, as I said, we just moved into the house 6 months before.
I just assumed he'd gotten old.
Yeah, no. He was only 67.
Yeah.
And his brother had died younger than that. So
really?
Yeah, and both of his parents were... You know, getting it back.
So they had bad genes with heart stuff and things like that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a shame because I'm sure as a physician he knew how to take care of himself.
Yes, he did.
And working on a farm.
Once he found out he had 3/4 closure of an artery. I mean, he didn't know that for years and ate like every other Southern boy, you know.
Yeah.
And then he got very careful, but...
Well, I'm sorry. That's really sad.
One thing I do want to mention really quickly, if anybody wants to know about his work as a physician,
the
studenthealthcoalition.web.unc.edu is where they can go to see the website of his papers, the work of the Student Health Coalition, which is all now housed at UNC in the Southern Historical Collection. I just wanted to mention that.
So you don't go
interested.
To the Student Historical Southern Historical Collection. You go to that. Instead?
Well, you can do it either way.
Uh-huh.
But this has just come online last
week. Okay, say it again.
studenthealthcoalition.web.unc.edu.
Oh, that's.
And you can also Google it through the Southern Historical Collection at UNC,
mm-hmm.
and I think they have it either as the Student Health Coalition or the Appalachian Student Health Coalition.
Okay.
Any of those can, I think, will eventually get there.
We'll say that again before the end of the program, but we're going to take a station break right now.
Yes, thank you. This is the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom show.
I think I forgot to mention that at the beginning of the show. I said
yes.
WILP.
Yeah. We are brought to you by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Triangle Branch.
It's our 100th year.
Our 100th year
nationally,
worldwide.
Internationally, and 80 locally.
80, right, here locally.
Our birthday year.
And so we're happily celebrating that, but we're still working for peace and justice and freedom.
And still trying to stop war.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's an uphill struggle.
Yes. And I just want to mention that Monday night and Dick, you might want to say something about that. Reverend Barber had a revival as in preparation for going on either a 15 or a 17 state moral revival tour James Forbes, Reverend James Forbes, who's retired from Riverside Church in New York, and Sister Simone Campbell, who organized the nuns on a bus who went around during the last election fighting against Paul Ryan's budget plan that was going to hurt the poor. They went around in their defense of the poor and the kind of work that the nuns and other good people are doing to help the poor and the hungry. And also, I think Tracy, and maybe Chapman, I'm not quite sure of her name, but she is an African-American minister with United Church of Christ. So the four of them are going to be going on this moral revival tour because the country needs a moral revival. I think he put it on Monday night's talk about needing a heart transplant, that there's too much meanness going on and your right. heart gets kind of blocked and cold, and you need like a revival of your heart. So just wanted to mention that because thank God for Reverend Barber. That's one of the good things that in this state, along with a lot of other good people, but I just wanted to mention that. And then Friday night, this Friday night, April 8th, is the NAACP's Freedom Fund Banquet. It's their one fundraising time to raise money for scholarships and for the work that they do. I think if you Google the NAACP, there may be a few tickets left. It's going to be at the Friday Center at 6 o'clock, so I just wanted to mention that also.
Right. I suspect that, according to the word I have, that if you do not have a ticket, but you want to show up and
they'll fit you in.
They'll fit you in.
Yeah, we'd the tickets are $50.
$50 in order
but
to raise
a lot
money.
Of that's going to scholarships. Plus your dinner. Your dinner at the Friday Center is always very, very good. And so you get dinner and you help some young people get to college. So
right.
that's a good deal. I'm not quite sure. Do you know who's going to be speaking, Dick? Sorry about that.
Yeah.
I should know.
Forbes and Barber, I think.
Huh?
Forbes and Barber are the two ministers there.
Not at the banquet.
Oh.
It's
No, they won't be at the banquet. No, they're on the tour.
Right.
But anyhow, somebody wonderful. That's all we can tell you. We should know. We're embarrassed. But it's going to be somebody wonderful. So if you haven't got a ticket, show up at the Friday Center and you'll be able to get a ticket there and get in. Is there anything else?
Well, yes. This is WCOM LP,
oh, yes.
Chapel Hill and Carrboro. And these are the facilities that we use to get to you. And you can either do it on your FM dial at 103.5.
103.
103.5, mm-hmm. Yeah. And if that doesn't work for you and you have a computer, you can go online to the radio station's website, which is wcomfm.org. And you can go to the website, click on the Listen Live button, and you can hear us from 5 to 6 p.m. every Wednesday. And you can hear other wonderful shows as well.
And I just want to mention, almost forgot, next week we are having another special show. We are having two women who are in our national office. They are co-chairs of our disarmament committee. And bless their hearts, they are so brave. They, a few months back, they did a tour. It's, their passion is about the abolition of nuclear weapons. They did a nuclear freeze a tour on the West Coast, and now they're doing the East Coast. So we're going to have them on our radio show. Ellen Thomas and Laura Ulmer, and they are going to be talking about the work towards abolishing nuclear weapons, but also about conversion of nuclear and fossil fuels into truly clean, sustainable energy. So those are the two things that these two women are so passionate about that they're going around in a van and going from Wolf Branch to Wolf Branch. So they're going to be on our show. Then they're going to be a little bit. Our show ends at 6. Our show's on from 5 to 6. Then at 7:30, they're going to be at the community church, and Jerry Marcatus is going to have them on his Balance and Accuracy in Journalism program. So you can go and listen to them on our show, and then you can go see them in person.
And ask your questions.
and ask them questions at the community church at 7:30. So I wanted to be sure that, so stay tuned. We have some great programs coming up, yeah. And so today we're having another terrific program. We are having Daryl Walker.
I would like to tell them what the website is for Women's International League for
Peace
and Freedom.
Yes, please do.
Yes, thank you. It is triangle, WILPF. Because we can't spell it all the way out. We never finish writing it down. TriangleWILPF.org.
Thank you.
One of the things you can find there is the archive of past radio shows.
And a lot of them are always very timely topics because a lot of these issues don't go away when we're talking about poverty, peace, sustainable energy. All of it stays very timely.
We also have other such things as
racism.
Racism, and we also have listed on there activities that are coming up that Wilf has sponsored or will sponsor in the future, mm-hmm. or ones that they have sponsored recently, so that you'll know what we're up to.
Mm-hmm.
And we would encourage you to come. Join if you would.
Yes.
But in any case, I think that's it.
Okay. So now we're back and with Daryl Walker, who is a partner with Bill Dow for the last several years of his way too short life. That's a shock. I didn't realize that. And she's brought a book that's just come out about a month ago. You can hold that up for the camera. What I Stand On, the writings, some words of Bill Dow. It's a very short book, but wonderful book from what I hear from Ed King, who's sitting in the radio the studio with us.
Laurie, these are actually a series of interviews.
Oh, okay.
I think I meant to finish that with Fred Broadwell.
Oh, yes.
Who came out to the farm over a period of a couple of years.
Oh, okay.
And he'd spend several hours with Bill, recording, asking him all kinds of questions. And so when Bill died, it had been transcribed, but nothing had been edited. So it sat around for several months. And you asked me if I had anything to do with it. And what I did was say, Fred, we've got all this material. Let's see if there's a book in it. And but it was really his baby.
Okay.
And so he started to edit it. He gave it to me. I edited it, gave it back to him. We went back and forth a couple of times. But he did the main reorganizing.
So you've got to give credit to Fred Broadwell.
Yeah, he's really the one that spent the time getting the words in the tape, getting them transcribed, and then editing and reorganizing it. Because the first time we both edited it, it was still too disparate.
Yeah.
And then I said, Fred, you know, and he sort of, he was going to do it seasonally. Uh-huh. But then there were so many topics Bill had touched on that he decided to do it topically, and it was much better because it really he could get into these different things.
Okay.
That Bill had, so that's how it came about.
Well, that's interesting.
So
yeah.
I was encouraging him a lot.
Yeah.
Because
he
had all sorts of other things he was doing, too, and getting married and traveling. And,
so
you know.
Fred Broadwell lives around
here. He's in Durham. And he is now, I think he's a sort of a sustainable ag consultant.
Okay.
Because he knows a lot about it, and feels very strongly about it.
Okay. And well, maybe someday we ought to get him on the show. Well, good for him and good for you.
Well, we finally produced it.
Yeah.
Well, and 20% of the sales we are giving to the CFSA conference attendees, because it's very expensive for young farmers to go there. But it's a wonderful 3-day conference. They can learn a lot. And this is a wonderful handbook for a young farmer, because Bill gets into so many tips on what he learned in the process of farming. But that's what we're doing with part of the sales, because we really felt wanted to
support
them.
It's a beautiful book, too.
Well, thank you. The cover, I wish we had color inside, but it was too expensive.
The cover is just beautiful. And
Debbie Roos took that picture. She was she did a lot of the pictures in there.
So I love this. What I stand on, practical advice and cantankerous musings from a pioneering organic farmer. That's just wonderful.
Well, Bill could dig his heels in the ground sometimes and be very cantankerous, as Ed knows. So it's an appropriate title.
So that's good. You know, you just can't be so perfect.
So
if one of your flaws is to be a little cantankerous, that doesn't sound too terrible. Probably he sounds like he's kind of stubborn, too.
Oh, yes.
But I guess to be such a pioneer in both medicine and farming, you have to be stubborn.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be passionate and stubborn.
Right.
And
exactly.
So this is now at Flyleaf. Let's give a heads up here to Flyleaf Books. You can get it there.
And McIntyre's. Yeah. And if you come to Pittsburgh, you can get it at the Chatham Marketplace or Angelina's Kitchen.
Okay. So there's many places that you can get this wonderful book, and we recommend it highly. Anybody who's interested in organic farming, I'm going to have to get this as a present for my grandson. I think I'm going to have to do that. back to you. So you, like Bill, been making a lot of changes in your life. I mean, going from being a drama teacher.
I never thought I'd be a farmer. And I can't really say I'm a farmer. But when Bill died, there was the farm.
What was the name of your farm?
It's Ayrshire Farm.
Ayrshire
It was
Farm.
Named for, he thought it was named, it was a funny story that's even in this book. Ayr Shire is an area near, not too far from Glasgow. And when he started on this quest to find his family history, he read about some Dows being in Ayrshire. And he said, it was about the time that he was naming the farm. And he said, I'll call it Ayrshire Farm. Well, the next year, I didn't know him then, he went over to Scotland and did some more research and found out that, in fact, maybe there'd been a Dow there at some point, but they really came from this area over on Perth, which is on the other side of the country. But it was too late. He was already officially Ayrshire Farm, so he said, I'll just leave it. He said, and then he's got a comment, and he says, she gives me an example of how you better do your homework before you start. So, but it's still Ayrshire, and I think the new folks have said that they're going to call it In Good Heart at Ayrshire or something like that.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure. They're going to try to keep the name in their title somehow.
So and they'll be still coming to the Carborough Farmers Market?
Well, they'd like to, but it's very difficult to get in
That's
there.
That's what I was thinking.
And they don't automatically get a place just because we were one of the first ones. It doesn't transfer that way.
Yeah.
They have to get on the list. But I'm hoping that they may go to the Wednesday market first, because that's easier to get into.
To get
they
in.
Don't have quite as many farmers. And eventually get into a place there.
Well, and the Carborough Farmers Market was like one of the first ones that I know of anyhow. But because it's been so wonderful and so needed and mm-hmm. so successful, there are now, there's one in Saxapaha. Mm-hmm. The hospital even has inside, and that's what sometimes the farmers like in the hot summer, it's mm-hmm. air conditioned. They have a Wednesday afternoon at the hospital.
Yeah.
And because another daughter has helped a farmer friend of hers and taken to do some of the selling for her at
right,
the hospital
right.
one.
Yeah.
And
University Place, isn't there?
And University Place.
Square? University Square?
No,
here,
no, not
in,
the square.
In
no, the, what used to be the University Mall.
Oh, out at
they
University
now have
Mall.
A new name.
Oh, they call it University Place?
They're getting.
Well,
they're,
see,
they're,
I don't live in Chapel Hill
they're,
anymore.
They're,
I don't
they've
get
gotten
all the
gentrified. They're getting very fancy.
Oh, my.
You know?
Yeah.
And also at Southern Village, I think, or at Farrington.
That's right, Southern Village and Farrington.
And
both
Farrington.
Have one.
So, and I'm sure in
and
Durham
got,
and in Hillsborough.
Two, and we've got two in Pittsburgh, too.
Yep.
And Siler City. There's
and
one in Siler City.
So,
they're all
know,
over the place.
When you get a good idea and it goes well, and there's farmers who want to sell their produce, you can't get in the Carborough one. Well, hey,
yeah.
there's some other ones
that's
that,
right.
that are, I think Hillsborough's got two of them.
I think you're right.
Yeah,
yeah
I think there
yeah.
was some little argument, and which sometimes happens with passionate people. So,
oh, yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. So those young people will find a place, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah. So that must have been such a relief that you could find the right people.
Well, it was, and then the question is, you know, where do I go? My grandchildren are in the Boulder area and wanted me to move out there. And I've been spending a couple of months, a year out there trying to decide whether or not I would do that. But I figured, no, I'm not quite ready to make that move. And my first husband and I bought a very old fall-down house in Beaufort back in the 70s for practically a song and a dance and spent 10 years ourselves as two teachers rebuilding it. We did everything except for the plumbing and the wiring all the way out to the siding. I mean, it was this awful house. But we did it right, and it's in good shape now. And so when we divorced, he stayed in Chapel Hill, and I got the house in Beaufort. So I'm moving to Beaufort. And that's
you
where I will
tell
go.
Me that
yeah.
on the phone.
Yeah.
Well, what a beautiful place to move
it
to.
It is.
I think Ed is making noises over there. Speak up, Ed.
Cuba.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes, thank you. I don't read lips.
Well, I thought that was going to be one of my transitions
yes,
because
yes.
that was definitely.
Yes, well, we may have to have you back another time if we don't cover everything, but that's right. You are just back from Cuba.
I am just back from Cuba last week.
And right. What a good time to go.
Well, it was amazing. I was there with my son. We went on a trip with a Rhodes Scholar because when we first started talking about this, last summer, the only way you could go was with a group.
Yes.
And subsequently, of course, since Obama's been there and he changed it so that individuals can go, it's hard to do because, you know, you rent a car, it's $100 a day, and things, they're not set up for
tourism. They don't have a lot of cars.
They're not set up for tourism at all, right.
Maybe
they
a donkey
have a lot of
you
cars.
Might have been a little easier.
That's right. But I saw the rental agency in the airport in Havana when we were leaving. But, yeah, and Obama came when we were there. So,
oh, boy.
So that was interesting because we were supposed to stay four nights in the National Hotel in Havana and work out of that to different places. After the second night, they said, well, we've got to pack up and leave at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning because Obama's bringing 5,600 press corps and entourage, and we've got to get out of here. Okay, so we're going to go 70 miles to Veradero Beach, which is a beautiful beach, but it's not Havana. And so we're all packed and ready to go at 8 o'clock the next morning. They say, whoops, well, everything's changed. We're going to stay here for 2 months. So I thought, oh, this reminds me of when I lived in Russia, when things just changed from 1 minute to the next, and you never knew why, but you just went with the flow, and that's the way it was. So we stayed, and then we went and visited all kinds of wonderful places, from Hemingway's Finca Farm, wonderful concerts and art museums and all sorts of old sites and forts and churches. And, you know, then we went out to Cienfuegos. We saw the Bay of Pigs. We ended up, let's see, what was the very last?
So you were
did?
With a group.
So we were with the group. And
which I would think would be a good idea.
It was helpful in terms of they took care of all the
because the otherwise you're sort of sometimes floundering around trying to, but you know if you're not there for a real long time, by the time you figure things out.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I could go back now and do it by myself.
Yeah.
But the first, and I do speak a little bit of Spanish, and I used it a lot. Oh, there was a fascinating place called Cuba Libro, which an American journalist.
I thought that was a drink.
I know Cuba Libra is the drink, and it was a take on that. Cuba Libro, Libro is book.
Ah.
And she had started an all English bookstore in Havana, which now has turned into a community center. She's giving out free condoms because they're very difficult to come by. She's trying to get medical supplies, if anybody knows any way to get her those. She's an amazing woman, and she has built this amazing network of support in the community locally. And so that was a fascinating stay to visit there and meet some of the kids that are involved in that thing. They're desperately waiting for computer access. Everything's dial up and very slow if they can even get on.
Yeah.
And
because we used to have a connection with the what was it, Ed, you know, the Pastors for Peace, and they used to have some very old buses, I think, and they would go to different places and collect medical supplies. Somebody, some guy up in Canada would get old computers and fix them up. Mm-hmm. And then it was the embargo, so they'd have to go to Mexico or some other place and get over from there, and they would try to stop them. And they would come to the Church of the Reconciliation.
Yeah.
And we'd have a potluck, and the grannies would sing, the Raging Grannies would sing.
Right.
And they were just so brave, you know, and this bus, they'd always be late because the bus had broken down, or very often, you know. So I'm so glad it's gotten easier to go,
Well, I think it will be increasingly easier. And they were the Cubans were really excited about Obama coming. I mean, they would come up to us on the street and go, "Obama, Obama, Obama." you know, we love Obama. And I would say, "Por qué usted le gusta?" And then one man, you know, went like this. He pointed to his skin. And he says, "Call me, call me." He has the skin like mine.
Like mine.
Because, you know, there are multicolors in Cuba. And then others would say, "Oh, embargo, embargo. He's going to get rid of the embargo." And I thought, "Oh, I wish he could. You know, let's hope that." But I want to share with you two observations that I had that really hit me. One being that these people are the most amazing, resilient, creative people I think I've ever seen. And I've been in a couple of third world countries, but this was, I mean, they have had so much hardship, which they admit was not only the embargo, but also their choices as a government were not good. I mean, that's what our Cuban guide said. He said, "We've made mistakes, and we want to try to correct those, but, you know, that's part of our poverty problem." Mm-hmm. We make $25 a month, everybody. Mm-hmm. Of course, the housing is free.
Mm-hmm.
The medical care is free. The education is free. And education and medical are amazing. This one young man we met at the Cuba Libro said his mother worked for $25 an hour here, but she's off in Brazil, one of 20,000 physicians that Cubans have trained to send into third world poor countries.
A lot of people,
they're all over the world.
That's their expert.
It's amazing.
Expert is doctors.
But they can't come here and help us.
And but they, you know what? When the guy who's the head of Fellowship of Reconciliation, the pastor was friends with Fidel, and when he was there one time talking about their all the doctors that they were training, he said, "Oh, I wish we had something like that in America for poor kids." And Fidel said, which was very smart, "Oh, bring them here. If they're poor, you know, we'll give them the training." And they did. They worked it out. Because the hard thing was when they got their training to get their residency back here. So, but they would have to promise to practice in a poor neighborhood for, I think, 10 years. You know,
good.
But he did that. But I thought it was so smart for propaganda to just say, "Yes, we'll help you Americans."
And
they did work it out, and then it was difficult difficulty where they could get their residency and get approved here, but they finally did work it out.
Yeah.
So I don't know how many.
His name was Lucius Walker.
Pardon?
Lucius Walker.
Lucius Walker, another
IFCO.
One.
New York.
I don't know.
Yeah, from in New York, their organization is about as old as ours.
Yeah.
But we claim to be a little bit older because we've been ongoing, and they had a couple of breaks where they folded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yes, they're 100 years old too.
Yeah.
But that was amazing what they did. So Fidel, you know, they considered we. With the embargo, we don't have a lot of things, but we do have education.
And I mean, their resiliency, like what they call during the special period, which was the time right after the Russians pulled out.
Yes.
And, you know, the Russians had provided them with all kinds of things to help them build up their infrastructure after the revolution. And they left, and everything went downhill fast, and they were hungry. And that's how they started the organic agriculture movement, and everything is organic in that country now. I mean, they were growing urban gardens that were 3x5 in their backyard so that they wouldn't
starve.
Pots
on their balconies.
It was amazing.
And
it was amazing.
That was where a strong government was a helpful thing because everybody shared in it. And everybody got a certain amount of calories, and a lot of people, that was a great, they lost 10 or 15 pounds, but nobody starved. Nobody starved. They shared, which is an amazing story.
Well, may I give you my one last point?
Yes,
because
it really
hit me, and that was I came away feeling like the United States is just right now, is just nothing but a bully to this little country because we do business with China, we do business with Russia. These are huge communist countries.
Yeah,
and here we are, Cuba. And our guide said, "Now we want you to know, we're not North Korea, and we love Americans." And they do. And why? I don't know at this point. But for us to continue this embargo to me is absolutely ridiculous.
Oh, it's insane.
It's just nuts.
It's insane.
Yeah, so I hope it'll change.
The point you're making, I'm very simpatico. I've felt that way for many years. Yeah. We've had some Wolf members who've gone to Cuba. Ed's been there. One of our, I don't know if you know Jean Chapman, but she's a physician. She was one of our Wolf members who was there some years ago. And they just say, you know, what a good place it is. And their government's not perfect, but it's not that bad
at
all.
Right.
No.
That's right.
No, it really isn't.
And it was horrible. Was there
with Batista?
The
poverty.
Just awful.
I mean,
corruption.
The corruption we considered did our playground for our gangsters, and that's when
we took all the oil and all the sugar. So it was just
incredible. So go Cuba. We're on your side.
70% of all the Cuban agrarian land was owned by foreigners.
Yes, and that's what our country and Britain, they get where somebody wants to stand up for their country when we've sort of made it a colonial.
It's a colony.
A colony, and that's what happened in Iran, which is another whole story. But they had a democratically elected leader, Mossadegh, and we made sure he got toppled and put in the Shah, and there goes the story, you know, because he wanted to nationalize the oil, so the profits could come to his people, who were very poor. It's a story that's unfortunately repeated a lot. But Cuba, thank God for Obama.
Yeah,
I don't like everything he's done, but that was one of that and the deal with Iran.
Well, the other thing I didn't know was that Fidel had come to this country after throwing over Batista and asked for help, and we said no, we're not helping.
And we
you.
Said no,
and that's when they went to Russia.
And I
thought, well.
That was Nixon.
Thank you for that raising that point because a lot of people don't know that.
I didn't know that.
And he's gotten a lot of good press, a lot of our news people. He was seen as this hero, you know, there he is fighting in the jungles and brave. And so he got a lot of good press. But our government was very leery of anybody, you know.
And after that happened is when he went back, I think, and nationalized the oil and the sugar, but not beforehand.
Not before.
Which I thought was really
he wanted to work with
I
us.
I didn't know that.
And he got to and Batista had looted the country.
Oh yeah,
it was desperately poor. They thought there'd be something to work with, and there wasn't. Right. So we came hat in hand and asked for help, yeah. And we were too leery about him, well, and turned him down. And then he was forced to go to Russia.
Yeah,
you know.
That's right.
So
that's,
there we are. Okay, we're going to be saying goodbye. Unfortunately, we could go on and on.
Thank you
to Daryl Walker, and she's brought this wonderful book, What I Stand On, and. Do we have time to get in? If you go on and go to the Student Health Coalition website, go studenthealthcoalition.web.unc.edu, and I hope you'll do that. Goodbye. We'll see you next week with two Wilf peace activists. Peace activists
traveling through.
And it's all going to be about nuclear power and
nuclear war, nuclear weapons.
Yes.
So, excuse me. It's time to go. We'll talk to you next week.
Talk-